for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
So we just heard about tankers that transports mini submarines into the Baltic. That sounds a little far-fetched, but to remind people, this is what the Italian Navy, the Flottiglia Decima Mas, which I mentioned in the last hour, did already in World War II. They had a tanker, Olterra, and you can look that up in the internet if you want to find it, was used to transport torpedo riders. They were riding torpedoes as a mini sub, really, and doing military operations against the Americans in the Mediterranean. Highly successful. They sank two battleships in Alexandria. And after that, it was clear that with a few people, it could have a huge impact. And that was the reason why everybody was interested. So in the Cold War, the Americans had these kind of tankers, which you might know from a James Bond movie where the same thing happened, was shown. But they also, the United States Navy has the USS Jimmy Carter, which is a dedicated spy submarine, which can transport mini subs and swimmer delivery vehicles. It can rip off cables in the sea or destroy pipelines, whatever. It's a dedicated submarine for these intelligence operation tasks, not hunting other submarines or shooting off rockets as a second wave nuclear deterrence. It's a dedicated intelligence operation submarine. But we were talking about these Italian mini subs, which were transported to their areas of operation by American ships. And as far as I recall, Ulla Tonanda, one of the ships is the Mormax guy. So the Americans had dedicated mini sub transporting tankers, which on the outside looked like tankers, and the inside there was a sub, right?
It was not just, they functioned as a tanker. You know, they went up to Helsinki or to Stockholm or to northern Swedish cities or whatever, but they let the submarine out where it should be, or this small medium submarine. They let it out, and then they went further up to deliver the oil or whatever, and then on the way back they picked it up again. So it was enough time for this medium submarine to do the maintaining work and then in the 1980s, to show up to make the Swedes hysteric, which actually happened. So it had an enormous impact, and it was a psychological operation that was one of the most successful, I would say, that ever have been. So it's a really sophisticated, it started probably with these when you use it for maintaining the hydrophones. And then when they already have these submarines, they could use it also for other purposes.
I think to explain something who is not a Navy specialist. The Baltic and all the seabed of the oceans is monitored by hydrophones, which are attached or lie around on the ground, and they take up the noises of the ships that ride above them. And nowadays, for example, in the Baltic, there's no ship that can move which is not identified, not ship class, but individual ship, by these hydrophones. So they're all over. They had to be maintained. They had to be, let's leave it there. And for maintaining them, somebody had to go there, a diver, look at it, recharge some of the equipment in there. And for this, the midget submarines were used. And it could be that these operations, which were highly secret because the hydrophone network was one of the most important secrets for the US Navy and the NATO navies, really, in that time, that somebody noticed that there was something going around and the waters doing something. And then by the fuss that was created by that, everybody thought it would be Soviets, that because that's the immediate thought of the military people when somebody was sneaking around in their waters. They said it was Soviet. So it could be that from learning from the hysteric reaction that occurred when these submarines showed up, that somebody came up with the idea, let's use that. Let's use this hysteria that comes and give kind of a training effect. This is what I had in my interview with Admiral James Lyons, who was thinking that the training effect that the military should have should be real. It should be not in a maneuver where you know that everything is fake, where it's scripted reality. They should encounter things which are so frightening to them that they consider them real. So he made sure that people from American bases were kidnapped, they were tortured, there were explosions on the, there was real gunshots on the compound. So he said, you need to be physical, you need to be real. So this is a backstory that could lead to these psychological operations, that the maintaining of these hydrophones in the Baltic was the overture for these PSYOPs operations. Please continue, Ulla.
Yeah. No, the Secretary of Navy at the time, John Lehman, argued that it was the Casey. It was Casey who and the committee under Casey that had taken the decision.
Who was the CIA chief? Bill Casey was the CIA chief in the Reagan years.
Director of the CIA, or Director of Central Intelligence, it's a formal name of it. So in that sense, you could say the idea with the underwater U-2 come even closer to reality, because the U-2 spy plane was a CIA plane. And CIA was directly involved in this kind of operation in Swedish waters. It was US Navy CIA operations. So it was, and the British, I would say, I mean, it's clear that the British had also an important role in this case. They could say, the Americans said, we didn't have any immediate submarines, so it couldn't be us, you know. But they used the Italian small midget subs, and they were very advanced, you could say. So
you were off for 1 or 2 seconds. So you might have to repeat what you said.
Okay, no, it was the Americans did not have their own, or they had some medium submarines, but not very much actually. And so they used these Italian ones. And that was, you know, ideal. And when I started to study these issues and found that, this description of the submarines, they fit with the Italian ones. So when I asked the Secretary of Navy in U.S., why did you use Italian subs? And he said, for plausible deniability. And of course, it was very good submarines also. So it was not just for plausible deniability. But it certainly had an important role. No one said it, you know, it was Soviet submarines in this. I mean, people from the CIA and from the Navy that I spoke to, they did not say it was Soviet submarines. It was, when I looked at the Congress hearings that were the then Chief of Naval Intelligence, John Butts, was questioned by the Congress Select Committee for the Armed Forces. And then they asked about the Swedish incident. And he said that the submarine in 1981 with this Whiskey class was a genuine Soviet submarine. But what is written about the submarine incident in 1982 is still classified. And it was obviously not a Soviet submarine or Soviet submarines, so to speak. So it's, and also I found British submarines that was able to carry two small midget submarines, Porpoise class submarine. Porpoise, actually. So it was a. You had a system which, you know, carrying medium submarines on merchant ships, on civilian tankers, and on larger submarines that were the mother submarine, who brought these small midgets to the area of operations in the Swedish archipelagos. And that's the fact. And this is a. I mean, no one, what I knew at the time, knew about this. I mean, I spoke with the Swedish former chief of intelligence, who was chief of intelligence at the time. And he, you know, had also written a report for the prime minister about this submarine, saying that these submarines do not fit with Soviet submarines. But he didn't say anything more. But when I asked him if it wasn't Italian submarines, and he said, yeah, maybe, then, yeah. So that's that was, you know, quite clear that they knew, or they at least suspected that this very much. And a few people on the Swedish side also knew about these hydrophones. And,
but we have to say that what we are talking about now is not general knowledge now. It was not general knowledge then. It is still something, you know, some people would call it a conspiracy theory. I think it's important to understand that, like in the, when we started in our conversation with a dual state, there is this reality of the Shushaluk incident, where four people are killed in a car, and this is proof that something is going on, which should never really have happened, because it's not what the democratic state is about. And this is very similar. These are things going on where it's a lot of research that you do, talking to intelligence personnel and to politicians and so on. But it's not that anyone could have read in the newspapers of that time, or seen on TV when he listened to it, or hearing on the radio. It's a separate reality of political, military actions that lead to political conclusions. In this case, that Olof Palme and the Swedish government loses their capability of policies. It is management of the military in connection of managing the media, which are not instructed to do something. They just work on their own. Nobody is paid for anything or bribed or whatever. It's just useful idiots that could be used for these operations. But it is a separate reality that we hear from you now, and you can watch my documentaries, but it's not general knowledge. So this dual reality of the dual state is something that I think we need to stress. You're talking about your investigations and about your proof, but as I said, double reality.
Yeah, and it was an interview with Caspar Weinberger, the U.S. Secretary of Defense in the 1980s, where he said that we operated regularly in Swedish waters to test the readiness of the Swedish Navy and the Swedish people. So that was a surprise, and that was for many. And it led to a submarine inquiry led by the former Swedish ambassador to Washington, Rolf Ekéus. And I was part of this inquiry. And it was, this was information that was, clearly a surprise to the prime ministers, who knew nothing about it. And they suspected. I mean, I would say Olof Palme, for example, he suspected, and he was informed that it was Western activity, but not from the military side, really. The military didn't tell him, and maybe someone privately told him, but I don't know. But I know that the former state secretary to to Defense Minister Sven Andersson had informed Olof Palme in the 1st of December 1983. And he and Sven Andersson was a very strong or very independent, if you say that, defense minister who acted very much alone. And the Prime Minister Tage Erlander in the 1950s and 60s said that you could not really trust Sven Andersson. And Olof Palme said to a journalist, did Sven Andersson cheat me? Because he had said that the submarines were Soviet submarines, but actually it was not. So and he, at the time when these hydrophones were deployed in Swedish waters, he was the defense minister, while Carl Frithiofsson, who was the state secretary for him, probably knew about it. So he, and after a meeting with the top military leadership, he told Olof Palme that these were Western submarines. And he told his son in early December 1983 that these were Western submarines. And the son was very surprised. He was actually the international secretary of the Social Democratic Youth Organization, Ola Frithiofsson. And he, you know, he trusted his father, but he was very surprised that he said that these were not Soviet submarines, because every newspaper wrote that these were Soviet submarines. So you could say this is a kind of, it. You could learn very much from this incident, because you could say all the mass media in this case were totally wrong. Every newspaper was wrong. It was two articles in one Swedish newspaper who were suspicious and said that this cannot really be true and so on, and said he had military sources that said it was Western submarines. But 99% of the media said it was Soviet submarines. And the same goes on, you know, on the later occasion also. So this is
Let's switch now again. We need to do some advertisement. And let's switch from this historic lesson that the media was completely wrong on this incident. And there, it's also, if you look at it, hardly anything is the way that it really was. The depiction of that, what you could listen 24/7 to newspapers of the highest quality, what they call themselves, and not understand one bit about what was really going on there. And then after the break, let's switch to the current events in the Baltic and make a comparison there. So please stay tuned.
The Reckoning with Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
People say, this is crazy. Why is Joe Biden doing this? It makes no sense. Well, first of all, Joe Biden's doing nothing. Joe Biden's lucky if he can make it to the podium. He's not running the country. The people running him are the ones running the country. His chief of staff, Valerie Jarrett, all of Obama's people, the senior executive service that Obama put in every single executive department. Joe Biden isn't running the country. And the people that are running the country, these are hardcore Marxists. In the words of John Kerry when he was running for president in 2004, America needs to be taken down a peg. This is their ethos. This is what they believe. It's all part of cultural Marxism. People ask, what's cultural Marxism? Well, Marxism is an economic philosophy where the people that control the means of production control the workers, and all the workers have is their labor to trade for money. And Marx was a revolutionary that advocated a proletariat overthrow of the capitalist system, implementing socialism. Well, cultural Marxism uses the same principles, but it applies it to things like religion and society and education.
Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
the story behind the biggest election takeover in history.
We're only now being able to finally confirm exactly how this worked.
Mark Zuckerberg and his wife are donating more money to local governments ahead of the election. $100 million on top of a $300 million gift.
The most money any individual has ever spent to win a presidential campaign in the history of our country.
The election was bought way before Election Day.
They stole it fair and square. They changed the voting rules in the middle of the game.
A nation divided, rigged.
It was a rigged election. People have to find out what happened.
At SalemNow.com.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
And we're back with Professor Emeritus Ulatunanda, who also had been on the third parliamentarian inquiry into the submarine incidents in Sweden. He was the civilian expert on submarines. So the basic outline of the story is that in a confrontation policy that the Reagan government wanted to have with the Soviet Union of that time, while later on, in the mid-80s, Gorbachev was going as a peacenik into a different direction. It was a strategic question of how to get rid of the European social democracy, which with Willy Brandt and Olaf Palme and with Kreisky from Austria was détente policy, and was the opposite of that. So the method that was chosen was this psychological operations of using Western submarines in Swedish waters to depict Olof Palme as a peacenik who would talk with the Soviets while they were doing what they wanted, and that worked. It worked to the degree that Palme later on was killed, and he was a depicted enemy within large parts of the security apparatus in Sweden before that. We don't go into that on this show, but the question is now that there was a reality, a separate reality, which was not transported via the media. It was not, some people in the government were suspicious of what was going on. We know much more about what was going on then. But now we have something, in a way, eerily similar. There is German-Russian Nord Stream pipeline, which the Americans have declared something that shouldn't exist. Biden has officially said, in the presence of the German Chancellor Scholz, he humiliated them and said the pipeline would be shut down. And when somebody asked, how will you do it? It's a German pipeline. He said, we will be able to do that. Believe me. Victoria Nuland says the same. And when the pipeline was damaged or sabotaged a few days ago, the former Polish foreign minister Sikorski said, thank you, USA. But officially, in Germany, what we hear, there's really nothing on the news that this could be a Western operation. The party interested in that mostly is, of course, the United States, not really the Russians. But we hear that in Germany, at least, we hear it is the Russians who did it. And what is it like in Sweden? What do we know about other countries? You're very familiar with Great Britain and the United States too. So what is your take on this event? Is that in a way similar to what happened in the Swedish? Could it be similar? Your take, please, on it.
Yes, thank you. First, may I just correct one thing? It was the third inquiry, the submarine inquiry, was not a parliamentary inquiry. It was a government appointed by the Prime Minister, actually. So it was not the parliament as an earlier inquiry. But that is, yes, I will talk about the present events. And it's clear that, in the same as in Germany, in Sweden and Norway, they also speak about it as, Russian, probably Russian operation and so on. And but it's typical when they interview the foreign minister in Norway, the journalist says, you know, people say that this was a Russian operation. And the foreign minister say, yeah, we don't know yet, but, you know, and so on. So it is, people on the top level seems to be at least a little bit cautious. And I think that, it's obvious, if you look at the interest, on who has the interest of doing it, it's certainly not the Russians or the Germans who own the pipeline. They will not destroy the pipeline. So it would be obvious that it's someone else.
And let's get a little bit into that, Ulla, because the official line in Germany, I can give you the argument, is that Russia wants to disrupt the unity between the European Union and the Western world. And so by destroying the pipeline, they can sow discord in the Western world. And that's why they sabotaged the pipeline. They even could have been able to deploy explosives while it was constructed. So that is the official reasoning that we are told is behind the idea that the Russians could do it. What is your take on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a statement I think is not very credible. But you could say when Biden, you quoted Biden from 7th of February when he had this meeting with Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, and he was asked then that if this is a what they should do and so on, then he said, you know, if Russia invades, that means tanks and troops, the border of Ukraine, then there will no longer a Nord Stream 2. Mm-hmm. We will bring an end to it. And then the question was, but how will you, the journalist, you know, said, how will you do that exactly, since the project and control of it project is within the Germany's control? I promise you, we will be able to do it. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is when you listen to Blinken today, the Secretary of State, he says that this gives us a tremendous opportunity. You know, this is pretty strange. He's talking about this destruction of the pipeline, and then he says, this will give us a tremendous opportunity. So, and he motivates it, or says that this is because Europe will no longer be tied to Russia. And actually, from the beginning, this pipeline, I mean, from the 1980 or late 70s, but from the early 80s, it was clear that the Americans were against the pipelines. They tried to stop them. One thing you could say is that this would be something of a coal and steel union, like what later became the European Union. This was because the coal and steel union was between Germany and France after the Second World War. And the idea was that the dependency between the two countries would make them much less likely to go to war against each other. This was very important peace project, and the idea with the gas and industry union that will be formed by the Russian, German gas dependency and industry dependency, because Russia got a lot of industrial products from Germany. So you would have the same kind of a dynamic. And this did not the Americans like. They wanted to stop it at any price, because that would put the Americans a bit on the sideline. And actually, the American influence in Europe was very much dependent on the threat from Moscow. That was always during the Cold War, and it was also afterwards. So the idea of interdependency between Russia and Germany was unacceptable to the Americans. So this was the logic of the whole system, and that would the Americans try to break. And they tried in the 1982 they had a very sophisticated development of chips, the computer chips. That was the Russians didn't have the capability to make them, or they didn't have them. So that means that they tried to get these things from the West. And what the CIA did was to manipulate these chips so the machinery would go crazy. And that's happened with the pump systems for the gas pipelines. And according to Tom Reed, who was the Secretary of Air Force and the Chief of the Natural Reconnaissance Office, or director, and that you have interviewed in your programs, he said that we succeeded to get these chips in the hands of the Soviets, and the pipeline was blown up. It was the gas pumps that was running crazy, and it became the biggest conventional explosion ever. And according to the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, this was an explosion of 1.3 kiloton, which is, it was 3 kiloton, I think.
3 kiloton.
3 kiloton, yes. And it was 1/5 of the Hiroshima bomb. So it's pretty strong, actually. So that was in order to stop the pipelines. And the same, it seems, has happened today. They don't want the pipelines. And the problem, what happened is that was a discussion in Germany if one should open the Nord Stream 2, the second pipeline. And Putin said that, if you're not happy with the gas prices, why don't we open Nord Stream 2? So you could get lots of gas for the winter, and you wouldn't have any problems.
I think we, again, have to explain something. This is not an academic problem in Germany. It's an existential problem, meanwhile. The prices for heating the homes has gone up between 2 times to 10 times. So for a lot of people, it means that they will not be able to sustain in their rental homes. The majority of Germans live in rental homes. They don't own the homes that they live in. And so you have to pay the price, but even if you own it. So, but for a lot of people, it means that they have a terrible problem. They will not be able to pay for heating in the winter. So there are a lot of tips how you can survive in a room that is not heated. This is very, very popular on the German media right now. Also, the prices are going up. The inflation rate is 10%. In the last weeks, it's all we're going into a recession, and the German industry, which is highly dependent on Russian gas, for example, the chemical industry, a stronghold in Germany, BASF, for example, and the car industry, they also need the cheap gas from Russia. They are run against the wall. So, and especially for many of the small and medium-sized companies, Germany is a country of the small and medium-sized companies. For them, it's terrible. There's a wave of bankruptcies starting right now. So this is not a little bit here, more and there. It's an existential problem for all of Germany. So the question was, would you open it? But I have to tell you, Ola, for example, for the gas explosion, which I had in my documentary, and I had the Secretary of the Air Force, Thomas Reed, testifying on it and telling how they saw it in the alarm system. And somebody said, what's going on in the Soviet Union? And somebody came and said, oh, it's us, the CIA, and said, okay, this is considered now a conspiracy story too, that it never happened. There never has been an explosion. This is what you can find now on the internet. And I wanted to get to something else that both of us encountered when I did my first documentary on the Swedish submarine crisis. We encountered something that immediately after it was aired in Germany and France, that on Google, you called me really and said, look up my name and submarines. You're an academic expert for Blue Water Navy and submarine operations. And you could not be found on Google. Immediately after the show, you were erased from, you were simply not non-existent, except for a story that ridiculed you as the Dan Brown of academia in connection with submarines. So that was something that at that time, both of us have asked specialists on that, and nobody was aware that this was a possibility, that the Google searches could be rigged. They only had heard about search engine optimization, that you get higher up in the ranking in Google, but not that Google would censor you. So that was one of the very first examples. For me, it was the first ever where I encountered something that I didn't understand at all at that time, that using the internet for information would lead you into nothing. And that is something in connection of what we have now, which I think is very interesting. It's kind of an information management that is connected to these kind of operations. Did I tell the story right, or was there a mistake in there?
Yeah, I think that I was writing for a historian project, parallel history project on the Cold War. And it was about NATO and Warsaw Pact, and it was academics in Europe and the United States. And I wrote an article about the submarines in Swedish waters. And that was in 2004, 2005, I guess. I wrote first, I think, a comment on one guy, and then I wrote a longer article. And
the parallel history project, that is also, again, something that was historians from the West and from the East working together on the history of the Cold War. I think it needs to be explained.
Yeah, yeah, it was most, yeah, it was, but it was mostly Western. Mm-hmm. And it was two Swedish people who wrote a critique of what I have written, the first article, and the problem was on Google that you could find their articles, but not my original article and not my criticism of their article. You could just find their article, so it became a very And then I turned to this the people who was running Parallel History Project, the IT people, and they couldn't understand why. Because it's like they put it up and it didn't glue into the system, you know. So it was a kind of automatic censorship in a sense. And then later on they succeeded. I don't know how they did, but it was a But it was very strange experience that only the criticism of your article appear, while not your article that is criticized and your criticism of their article appear.
Yeah, I think why it is important is that it's a first instance, and no, as I said, nobody understood it. Of course, it was most important that in the moment, for example, the documentary is there and there's discussion about it, and then you look up the people that are named in the discussion, and that's a similar thing with the chips that had been used. You have the Secretary of the Air Force telling the story, writing in a book, and then it disappears on the internet. And that's the first instance then where something like that happened and nobody could interpret it because it was first. It was, but somebody must have done it. Somebody must have ordered it. Somebody must have talked to Google to do it. That is something you see that there are structures which are parallel, which are dual state structures, which have now a possibility to create situations in the internet, in the IT economy. This is, again, the story that we started with of the parallel of the dual state. And it's used to run, including what you know and what you hear and what people could be seen in the media. And if a journalist tries to check who this Ubla Tunanda is, and the only thing he finds is that he's a nutcase that shouldn't be listened to, then the problem is over. And if we find your work again after 5 weeks or so, then the problem is already solved. You are already discredited. That's what I think is important.
No, I think, and when it comes to the, if we could just go back to the deep state, again, the problem there, that it was actually this article that I wrote that we had, it was a conference in Australia, and it was a conference called, I think, the Government of the Shadows or something like that. And I gave my talk there, and then Peter Dale Scott, who was also at the conference, he picked up this analysis and wrote about it in his upcoming book that came in 2007, I think, where he mentioned the deep state and as something, you know, parallel to the regular state. And then this was picked up by a lot of people in the US system that I was not people that are a little bit different views from me, but had some influence, like Donald Trump and these people. So this made the concept very popular in United States, and he. This was a so. It was one guy from the Naval Postgraduate School who wrote an article on the history of the deep state. That brings up exactly what happens, actually, and where he also says, you know, that the number of people, the percentage in the United States who believed in a deep state suddenly were you know, more than 50%. So it became kind of it became something very real, actually.
Let's get back to this after we have to have another advertisement round. Let's get back to this topic and again attach it to the Baltic incidents, because I think this is what is the main thing for the future. So please stay with us.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
So it turns out that if you're a stressed out coffee drinker, you're in luck. You might be helping yourself stay healthy and maybe even helping yourself live longer. I kid you not. There are two separate studies. StudyFinds.org says researchers from the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine say the immune system can actually benefit from a little stress. Although stress plays a role in a number of health issues, the study finds it may also protect the body in certain circumstances. Experiments were conducted on mice. The message is that a little bit of stress is good in your life, but you want to be stressed in the right way. I don't know what that means. The other study says drink 2 to 3 cups of coffee a day for longer life and better heart health. It was authored by the head of clinical electrophysiology research at the Baker Heart and Diabetes Research Institute in Melbourne, Australia. The results suggest that mild to moderate intake of ground, instant, and decaffeinated coffee should be considered part of a healthy lifestyle. Coffee and stress. Who knew? Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
My therapist had told me that I needed to go to AA meetings, but I wasn't sure whether I wanted to go because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. That was not what I wanted to grow up and be. I didn't want to go to AA, but I did, and it wasn't what I expected by any means. It was friendly. I could feel it. I mean, I could feel the happiness. It's really great.
Visit AA.org for more information and download the Meeting Guide app to find a meeting near you.
Democracy is under attack. Western governments are trying to regulate the internet to shut down free speech. The Australian government has partnered with Twitter, Google, Apple, Meta, Facebook, TikTok, and Yahoo to regulate what Australians can and can't say on the internet. Disagree with what government is saying, and you'll be shut down and could face severe penalties. To find out more, go to digi.org.au. Lighting the fuse for freedom. This is TNT Radio.
Okay, and we're back with Ola Tunanda and the story of the dual state. You were describing, you are really the one who brought the term of dual state into the academic world and into the public sphere. What do you consider, what is the information, is there kind of an information management going on right now with the Baltic incident, or is it too early to talk about that?
I think it's clear that it is information management going on. Exactly what's going on is maybe not so easy to say, but when it comes to this incident in the Baltic, what we are talking about, this blowing up of the gas pipelines in the close to the Danish island of Bornholm, it's very many interesting things. I mean, firstly, of course, as I told before, that Biden said that we're going to stop it. It's not going to be a Nord Stream 2. And secondly, you have Blinken today saying that this, you know, catastrophe, if you want, gives us tremendous opportunities because it really makes it the difficulty for a closer ties between Russia and Europe, or Russia and Germany. So this is quite clear. But then, who did it? And when it comes to explosives on a pipeline, you could put it there in beforehand, sometime before. So it doesn't have to be done just immediately before it happens. And secondly, it has been very forceful explosives. So it's not just a small thing that done by some kind of a private actor. And I think everyone nowadays agree that this is a state organization. And then who did it? And at least you could see the interest. You could say that the Americans had been very explicit that they want to stop the pipeline. And the Poles tried to stop more than a year ago, maybe 1 year and a half, actually. They tried to stop the building of the pipeline with a ship. So it's no doubt that the Poles are not happy about it. We're not happy about the pipeline. But on the other hand, the former foreign minister of Poland wrote on Twitter that about this explosion, "Thank you, America." You have to try to figure out why did he write that. But he did. And he said it was a lot of joy when he realized it. And so it was clear, you know, a Polish interest. And he, maybe it was kind of Polish participation. Many people said it was a Polish participation. And maybe he wanted to put the blame more on the real actor that was America. But some people argue that it was also other countries. And I mean, what if you first look at the U.S. Alternative or U.S. Hypothesis, then you could say that it was an exercise, June, July, a few months ago, with a called Baltops, and it was a major U.S. ship so that were able actually able to carry midget submarines. And this ship was that was having exercise just close to the island of Bornholm, exactly where you had these explosions. And the exercise was about mine to find the mines and to, you know, training to get to find mines and get rid of mines. But it's the same instruments that they use to find the mines as you want to use, that we'll use to find the pipelines. So it's at least, this gives you at least some indication that it might have been a U.S. activity at this very time. And then it was helicopters operating from Poland in September that followed the pipeline. And but it was also some Swedish ships operating exactly at the places where these explosion took place. And that was 2-3 days, 3-5 days before the explosion happened. So it was these two ships came from, I think, I'm not sure if it was more than two, but they wrote, it was an article a couple of days ago in the Swedish Dagens Nyheter, and it was confirmed also by the military forces that these ships had been at these places. They had found the positions of the ships, and if it was two or three, I don't know. But they were operating in this very area and exactly at the positions of where the explosions took place. Maybe they, for example, were checking out. Maybe they knew that something was going on and whatever. I don't know. But at least their positions were at the places where you had the explosions. So this make it possible, but you don't know. I think
The thing is, for me rather, when I hear that, how is it possible that the media in Europe, and you said the same is true for Sweden as it is for Germany, how along with these how can you come up with the idea that that it is that the Russians blew it up? They should have some indication at least from the Western side, and I think the Baltic is a place where no one can move without being tracked. So will we hear something? Do you think we will hear something from the Russian side? What they have what they have encountered in terms of measurements, hydrophone intelligence operations, what was going on there? Will we hear something from the Western side, what was going on there? Or will it be a miracle like the Swedish operations with the submarines that will go on for decades to come before anybody understands something?
Yeah, I don't know. I think but it's clear that there is a similarity. There is a similarity. And because you could say that when it comes to the newspapers in Sweden, every newspaper, every big newspaper said that these must be Russians, because whoever could it be? I mean, you know that the Russians do things that are not always legal or something like that. And there is a kind of romanticizing of what the Western countries are doing. And I think when it comes, you know, they speak about hybrid warfare, you know, that you are doing warfare with not really military means, but you are doing it by making incidents, by creating a false understanding with psychological operations, for example, and so on. But that was what the Americans called low-intensity conflict in the 80s. That was the U.S. policy for Europe. And I guess it's the same, still the same. It is, it's not, I mean, when the Russians wrote about hybrid warfare, as I understand, this was because they learned from the Americans. So it's not a, the origin of the hybrid warfare in that sense is not the Russian, but the U.S. policy. And it was very clear, for example, by Fred Iclair, who was Under Secretary of Defense.
Ulla, we are close to the news on the hour, so we might have to go on.